It's 11:06 on Focus 580. Good morning. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. On the controls, Jason Croft, our producer this morning, Harriet Williamson. In the second hour of Focus, we're going to be talking to Alexander Sanger. Alexander Sanger has written a book entitled Beyond Choice, Reproductive Freedom in the 21st Century. And he is the grandson of Margaret Sanger, the founder of the birth control movement over 80 years ago. He is currently the international chair of the International Planned Parenthood Council and serves as a goodwill ambassador for the United Nations Population Fund. Mr. Sanger, good morning.
Good morning.
And thanks for being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
If you have a question for Alexander Sanger, you can call 333-9455. If you're out of the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. As always on Focus, we do ask that you do keep your questions sort of brief and to the point so that we can get as many calls in as possible. Mr. Sanger, I think if you don't mind, maybe we'll just sort of start off with a little historical perspective as to who was your grandmother. And how did you get involved in the Planned Parenthood movement?
Well, my grandmother was the daughter of Irish Catholic immigrants, and her beginnings, her decision to start the Planned Parenthood, the birth control movement, came from two things that happened in her life. One, that her mother was pregnant 18 times and had 11 children, 7 miscarriages, and died at age 49. And she had to drop out of school in the 11th grade, bring up her younger brothers and sisters. And she never forgot the connection between unplanned pregnancy and early death for women. My grandmother became a nurse, and she nursed women on the Lower East Side of New York who were going to back alleys for abortions back in 1910, 1912. And one too many of these women literally died in her arms, and she said enough, something had to change. And that got her going, trying to make birth control available and legal for the women who needed it in this country and around the world. She was an inspiration to me. I saw her give the last speech she ever gave. She was about 82 years old and in pretty poor health. But she was an inspiring woman. She was magnetic, very soft-spoken, but very persuasive. And believed her entire life that her cause would elevate the status of women and enable them to become full citizens in this country.
Mm-hmm. And how about yourself? How did you get involved with Planned Parenthood?
Well, my grandmother really was an inspiration. I studied her in college. I wrote my senior history thesis on her life. I was the first person allowed into her archives after her death. And I read her diaries and her letters and all the notes she kept over the years. And I kind of tucked that away in the back of my mind over the years. I practiced law and was in business for about 20 years. And it was the Reagan administration that inspired me in a funny way to join Planned Parenthood, because he instituted a gag rule on doctors. And the first President Bush also did this, trying to prevent family planning doctors in federally funded clinics from talking about the alternative of abortion for women who came in and got a positive pregnancy test and decided they didn't want to be pregnant. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to give birth. And the Reagan administration and the Bush administration said these doctors were not allowed to mention abortion. I thought that was an outrage. Both my parents were doctors, and I believe the doctors should be able to give advice to their patients and lay out alternatives for patients. So that was the impetus. Mm-hmm. For getting me into Planned Parenthood.
You have previously served as president of Planned Parenthood of New York City. And, you know, I found it interesting. Is there one, I guess, right up top, is there any topic in our country today that that people have stronger opinions on than reproductive rights and abortion and sort of where they fall down on what side of the line?
I think it's probably the most contentious issue in our so-called culture wars today. I think it's probably always been. For the last 200 years in this country, we've been fighting about reproductive issues. Certainly civil rights in its time was enormously contentious. We had a civil war over it. And gay rights today, the issue of gay marriage, certainly leads to sharp differences of opinion. But, you know, reproductive rights, the first law criminalizing birth control in this country was in 1821. When our country was founded, birth control was legal. So was abortion, by the way. Abortion was legal. And we've been fighting about this back and forth for almost the last 200 years. It's amazing in our country's history. We've gone from abortion and birth control being legal to being totally illegal, now legal again, and now there's a huge part of the American people want to criminalize it again. We can't seem to make up our mind.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Beyond Choice, you start off with, I think, a very interesting story about you and your wife. You have three sons, and I think this one refers to your middle son. Is that correct?
Yes.
Somewhere along the line during the pregnancy, you were told that there might be a genetic problem. Do I have that right?
Yes. My wife's has a genetic disease. Fortunately, not a very serious mm-hmm. one, but it involved hip dysplasia,
mm-hmm.
Which she has. And the doctor said, "Well, this is genetic." And he said, "You know, someday we'll have a test where you can determine whether your unborn child, your fetus, your baby is going to be going to have this disease." And my wife responded immediately. She said, "I would never kill my baby because it had hip dysplasia."
Mm-hmm.
So that led to an interesting conversation my wife and I had when we left the doctor's office, where she said, "Oh, of course, I think abortion ought to be legal, but I'm not going to have one just because there might be a genetic problem with a baby I'm carrying."
And
certainly an awful lot of women who feel that abortion should be legal and available are not going to have it themselves.
Right. I think you make the comment then that sort of puts her right where most of America is.
I think absolutely. I think most of America, and certainly all the polling, whether they like abortion or not, think it's moral or not, whether they think it's right for them or not, think it ought to be available to other women who think they need it and who, for some reason, cannot have the child that they're carrying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a call on line one. Let's go to that call right now. Good morning. You're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
Good morning. It's pleasure to talk to you. The title of your book is Beyond Choice. I thought, you know, choice was the most important thing that women can have about their reproductive life. But what do you mean by beyond choice? That's I find intriguing, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I'm glad you got the message and were intrigued by the title, because that's what publishers, of course, want to do and authors want to do. My argument is that the arguments based on choice have not been effective in changing American public opinion. The polling, to the extent we believe polling in this country, shows that public opinion about abortion has not changed since 1975. The Gallup poll, which has been doing this polling the longest, asked questions about abortion with exactly the same wording over the last 30 years, and it shows the American public opinion hasn't changed a single percentage point. So I believe in choice. I believe in women's autonomy. I believe that reproductive decisions are better made by individuals, by women, rather than by the government. But alas, these arguments have not been persuasive in reaching the American people and getting them to change their mind and become more pro-choice and actually maybe vote on the issue when they go into the ballot box and vote for candidates who share that opinion. So that's why the book is called Beyond Choice. I'm trying to present some new arguments based on some what human nature is all about, what biology and human evolution have to add to the mix, and to try to ask for the American people the following question: why should there be reproductive freedom in the first place? That is not a question we in the pro-choice movement have asked, and we certainly haven't answered it. I believe that answer is based on saying that it's a woman's choice, it's a matter of woman's autonomy. While they're true, don't answer that fundamental question about why women should have that freedom in the first place. And that's the question I am trying to answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's 11:16. If you have a question for Alexander Sanger, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we are talking about his book, Beyond Choice, Reproductive Freedom in the 21st Century. You use the term reproductive strategy in your book. for women and for men. Would you mind telling us what you mean by that?
Yeah, people don't have children randomly or haphazardly or by chance. Every one of our ancestors and we have our children strategically. It may be unconscious, but there are elements of strategy in how we time and space and plan our children for the best possible outcome. And the outcomes include having the woman survive childbirth, having the child be born healthy, and get the child enough food and shelter over the next 21 years to get that child to adulthood. This is the biologists have been figuring out over the last 20 more years, the whole field of evolutionary biology has developed, showing that all animals, including ourselves, do have reproductive strategies. The Mother Nature has a system through the process of evolution, through the process of natural selection, where every species tries to see to it that their progeny survive, their children survive. We are no different. Women have had to evolve to plan and space and time their children because pregnancy is so dangerous. Pregnancy has been throughout all of human history the biggest killer of women, the biggest preventable killer of women. And women die from pregnancy because their pregnancies are spaced too close together. They're too young to give birth. They're malnourished. And that's what birth control and abortion, to a lesser extent, allow women to time and space and plan pregnancies. Because when a woman dies prematurely, leaving children behind, it's a lot less likely that those children are going to survive to adulthood. And women have evolved to play the odds, so to speak, to do what it takes in order to get their children to adulthood. And abortion involves a trade-off. It's in many ways a sad one. To many people, an unacceptable one, to trade an unborn life for the lives of children who may already be born or for the lives of future children not yet born. But that's what reproductive strategy does. Women are trying to give their children the best chance of survival, getting to adulthood. And in turn, having children.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to the phone lines. Line one in Urbana, you're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what he would have to say about the growing definition of what constitutes a fetus. I remember when the IUDs were originally introduced, they were supposed to stop an embryo from implanting, and that was not considered an abortion. Now I understand that with Plan B, it's considered by many people that this prevents a fertilized embryo from implanting in the wall of the uterus. And now a certain group of religious pharmacists are saying that that is a fetus and that constitutes an abortion. Also, the embryos that are kept in frozen in petri dishes, they are considered... they're considered babies with a soul and snowflake babies, as Senator Brownback calls them, and that's considered an abortion, too. So I just wonder where the definition is going to stop. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I guess for your listeners who aren't familiar with the term Plan B, that refers to a brand of emergency contraception, the so-called morning after pill, which women can take up to... 3 days, sometimes up to 5 days after unprotected intercourse or if a condom breaks, and it reduces the chances of pregnancy by about 85%. And so the caller correctly points out that there's a lot of argument out there about question: when does life begin? When is there a human being? When does the soul enter the body? Aristotle wrote about all this back, in the 4th century before Christ. It's been the age-old issue about when does life begin, when is there a human being, and these are all different questions that we kind of have to parse out. The one thing that biologist. Now, I believe in starting with the biology before we get to the religion and the morality, because I don't think we can come to religious or moral conclusions about life until we understand maybe really what the biological foundations are that we're talking about. And 3 out of 4 fertilized eggs do not survive the 9 months to be born. Only 1 out of 4 fertilized eggs, when left to its own devices, survives those 9 months. Half of fertilized eggs do not implant in the uterus, and half of embryos that are implanted miscarry. So that leaves 1 out of 4 that are going to make it the 9 months to be born. And, you know, when you leap from that and then you try to come up with a religious or moral conclusion about that, or moral conclusion about when the soul enters the body, it's pretty difficult for me to come to a conclusion that there's anything particularly sacred or holy about a fertilized egg, since Mother Nature has the system, or God has got a system, that 3 out of 4 are not going to be born. They die. They don't survive. They're killed by nature. So I think when you look at it from that point of view, I think we probably ought to give a little bit of leeway to women who need to make decisions about whether or not they want to be pregnant, and not treat a fertilized egg or even an early embryo as something necessarily worthy of the protection of the law. And actually, that's where Aristotle came out. He came out and said the soul entered the body after 40 days of gestation for a male embryo and 80 days of gestation for a female embryo. And that's, you know, in some minds, a 4th century B.C. Greek, sexist joke. But he came to that because back then they thought that the female was a mutation from the male, and they thought it was longer for the female to get formed, and therefore the soul was delayed entering the female body even more than the male.
Interesting. It's 11:23. Let's go to line number 2. Urbana, you're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
You just say what I was going to talk about. I have a relative who had suffered 2 miscarriages and already had a normal birth, 2 miscarriages, and then a child born with birth defects in her legs. Her legs are, the bones are not right. And in that case, the parents chose to continue the pregnancy. But I was telling my daughter-in-law, who has 2 young children of her own now, about the miscarriages, so that the family would be aware, because the niece wasn't talking about it. And my daughter-in-law, who's a biologist, said, you know, it used to be that we didn't really know how many miscarriages were happening really early because we didn't have really good pregnancy tests. And now even the home pregnancy tests are pretty good, and so women are becoming much more aware of how frequently they actually miscarry. And she was saying this puts a lot of pressure on people who are trying hard to conceive, and I can see that. I'm also going to say that in nature, that's the way that nature takes care of errors that happen in the cell division and birth defects that are fatal. I suppose it's also possibly a problem if the environment isn't correct. And I'm wondering whether, with all this emphasis on the fertilized egg being a human being from the Right to Life folks, whether we're going to have people, women, if this is allowed to be projected toward the future, you could have somebody who smokes, I don't think people should smoke, but who ends up with an early miscarriage being prosecuted for murder because she didn't have the right environment in her uterus because she was smoking or who knows what. Naturally, many other organisms also have, not all fertilized eggs survive. And there's sort of this overproduction of eggs so that you have a certain percentage surviving. And you also have situations where the mother may abandon or not nurse or whatever a newborn. I'm talking about animals that are not well enough to survive. I'm not suggesting that we do that now, but in a way, our government seems to do that by emphasizing fertilized eggs and not taking care of people once they're here. It's almost as though you have a right to life if you're a fertilized egg. But once you're here, well, it's your fault if your parents are poor.
Okay, let's let Mr. Sanger comment some good points.
Well, it sounded to me like you were reciting one of the chapters of my book, and we're certainly on the same wavelength. I think what reproductive strategy means is that we've got to look at the totality of the reproductive process, which involves, first of all, trying to find a mate, a suitable mate, and then trying to get pregnant, which is not easy, as I said, when 3 out of 4 fertilized eggs don't make it, and then survive childbirth, and then nurse the child. I mean, the humans are almost unique in being defenseless and helpless for the first 3 or 4 years of life, needing enormous protection from both parents and nurturance. And then, waiting, hopefully, at least until you're in your 20s with an educated and working before you start having children. We know that doesn't always happen, but that's probably most parents would consider that a goal. And this takes a lot of work and a lot of effort by parents and grandparents to make it happen, which is why reproductive control and autonomy, I believe, is so important, because it does take so much effort, and it's fraught with difficulty, and there are dangers everywhere. Our government, the role of government, I believe, should be helping people make the reproductive decisions they want to make and not getting in their way, and not only leaving the decision to become pregnant and give birth to the individual, but also making sure that we've got a system where your children are nurtured and get the nutrition and get the care that they need to get to adulthood so they can repeat the process.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call. Our guest this hour on Focus 580 is Alexander Sanger, and he's talking about his book, Beyond Choice, Reproductive Freedom in the 21st Century. I also wanted to mention, Mr. Sanger, I forgot to do this during the introduction. You're going to be in our community tomorrow night as the featured speaker at the Planned Parenthood of East Central Illinois gala event celebrating 65 years of service. And hope you enjoy your visit to Champaign.
I plan to. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line number 3, Champaign County. You're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
The point that was just said about universal health care for the fetus, but nothing after partum. So I think that's such an important issue, because we ought to live in a society that actually values everyone and who is alive and has universal health care. But it's an absolute atrocity that we can be arguing about this, and then there are many people, many children, even young children, who are not getting reasonable care at all. I wanted you to review the hearings. I endured every bit of it. I want to congratulate this woman, Thistlethwaite, from Chicago Theological Seminary, for holding her side up in it. But particularly the language that was coached to Roberts, I mean, he's a bright man, but obviously he was coached a lot, and he used exactly the same formula. I have no quarrel with that aspect of privacy or something like that. What do you make of it? What stuck out for you? How do you assess the circumstance? I know this could go on the rest of the hour, but I also want to typically, as I point out, University of Illinois Press, as far as the beginning of life and the origin and all, published a book called A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion some years ago. It didn't have a lot of impact, it seems to me, and I think it's worth mentioning again. Gary Wills reviewed it in the Chicago papers, but no widespread impact. And it goes into this whole history about Aquinas and the quickening and the whole idea that ensoulment happened at a much later date than is claimed now. We have this fellow from Oklahoma, I forget his name now, claiming that there are brain waves at 18 days or something like that. It's absolutely surreal what's being offered these days. So I'd like to hear your response to some of that. And I guess I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. I guess your first point on universal health care, the people who need health care the most are the people who don't have it in this country, and that's the poor. Because there's a direct correlation between poverty and and bad health. And women, poor women, for them, pregnancy is much riskier than for middle-class wealthy women. They're much more likely to have problems during the pregnancy, difficulties with the childbirth, low birth weight babies, premature delivery, and then care needed for these low birth weight infants after birth. And that is why I absolutely believe there should be universal health care, especially and targeted even more than our system does now to poor people. Our Medicaid system simply doesn't provide the care that poor people need, especially prenatal care. I mean, one of the great scandals in this country is the inability of poor women, even when they're covered by Medicaid, to access prenatal care because the doctors simply just won't provide it. Clinics, either can't or won't provide this very necessary part of health care. The John Roberts hearings, the man was very carefully coached, talking in code. Certainly didn't make the mistake that Robert Bork made, saying there's no such thing as a right to privacy. But the question that's open is, okay, now that he said there's some kind of right to privacy, we don't know what it really means, because Justice Thomas said the same thing in his hearings. He said there was a right to privacy, and ever since he got on the court, he hasn't found it anywhere. And it doesn't seem like Justice Thomas thinks there ought to be a right to privacy even for contraception. At the other end of the scale, we have Justice O'Connor, who found a right to privacy that encompassed the right for a woman to make decisions about childbearing. And then somewhere in the middle is Justice Rehnquist. This is the seat that Roberts is taking, and Rehnquist said in one of his dissents that there was a right to privacy that did encompass birth control, but it did not encompass abortion. So it's an open issue. Where is Roberts going to come down on that spectrum? I can't predict it. Planned Parenthood, because he refused to make a commitment, came out and opposed the nomination. And it's really a crapshoot voting for this man for the Supreme Court. And really not knowing what he thinks about any particular issue. It was really quite revealing. He kept on saying, I can't give opinions about cases that are going to come up to the court, and yet he did on a number of issues that are likely to come to the court. He actually gave his pretty detailed opinions, but not about abortion or anything related to reproductive freedom.
Okay, our numbers to call are 333-9455 locally if you have a question for Alexander Sanger. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, and let's go to that 800 line right now. Chicago, you're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
My comment has to do with the issue of informed consent. There's been a lot of research showing the links between abortion and breast cancer and even health effects of contraception. And so it comes down to the point that a lot of women have been, sold abortions without being informed of the health consequences. And it goes into the area of parental notification as well, where, young children are being given contraceptive, pills and devices without really the parental consent. And a parent would normally have some input into health consequences and things affecting the health of their children. And I'm just wondering if you can comment on this. It seems to be, the lack of informed consent regarding these things.
Well, I start out with no one should be subject to any treatment or take any medicine unless they do give informed consent. And let's just talk about adults for the moment. Who have the intelligence and the ability to give informed consent. There are, and I have a whole chapter in my book about this, talking about the impact and the health effects of contraception. And this is something that's still being studied. There are a lot of open issues out there, especially the relationship between when you're on hormonal contraception, the relationship between that and your likelihood of contracting a sexually transmitted disease. I think we have to do a lot more study. I know that at Planned Parenthood, every patient is told if they go on hormonal contraception, they also have to make sure they use condoms every time they have intercourse, no matter who they're having intercourse with, the husband or otherwise, because of the risk of sexually transmitted diseases. But you know, you're raising very serious issues. I have not seen any definitive studies. I've seen contradictory studies on the whole breast cancer issue and abortion. The most reliable and unbiased ones I've seen come from Europe, because in those countries they actually have a national registry of people who have had abortions, and it's part of the, and they track everyone in those countries for everything that's wrong with them, and they have not found a connection between abortion and breast cancer.
I understand.
So I think that there's more. Certainly, studies ought to be done in this country. The issue of course, of minors is a very serious one. Do we permit any kind of medication going to anyone who's under the age of 18 without a parental consent? And the contravailing public health issue, you might think instinctively, well, of course not. You've got to have parent consent to that. And the contravailing public health consequence of that is, okay, are you going to have more unprotected sex, more unintended pregnancy as a result, with all the health consequences that have that flow from that? And what is better for the health of people who are minors, making sure they get parental consent or making sure they don't get pregnant? And again, a very serious issue, and people who are very thoughtful can come down on either side of that. Where I come down is it's better to have people not get pregnant, especially young people, because they're not suited in most cases to be parents. We'd like to prevent them having abortions are not necessary for them to go through that type of procedure.
Well, there's a website, abortionbreastcancer.com, I think .org maybe, but where you can actually, there's vast research on this question, and I think if a person wants to know a little bit more about it, they can maybe look that up on there. But it just seems to me that many people are put through this procedure without really aware of these health consequences. It's so important in anything to know what you're doing, what you're getting yourself into.
No question about that. And I know that there is counseling and information, certainly at the Planned Parenthoods, I hope at other institutions as well, where this issue has been raised. And actually, some states have even mandated that this discussion happen when you go into a doctor's office to talk about it. I wanted to say that one of the previous caller talked about the University of Illinois Press. They also published the selected papers of Margaret Sanger. And so some of your readers might want to, some of your listeners might want to get that volume also.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Our number is 333-9455, or if you're out of the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. Mr. Sanger, you mentioned one strategy in your book that sort of made me sort of step back a little bit. You know, that teen pregnancy can sometimes be a good reproductive strategy. Doesn't that really go against our sort of societal thinking at this point in time?
Well, it goes against societal thinking, goes against my thinking, because I just said...
I was going to say what I mean. I wanted to sort of follow up, because you just made that comment that just to the previous caller. And
exactly. The point about teens is that teens, like adults, have reproductive strategies, and they may be unconscious and they may not be thinking them through. But teenagers, Mother Nature is really playing tricks with us. The age of menarche is now 11 years old for young girls, even 10 years old, and sometimes younger. Changes in diet and lifestyle and maybe the environment have led for the ability of young girls to be able to menstruate and get pregnant a lot earlier than they did in our grandparents' time. And what do we do about this? And poor minority teens living in inner cities face real difficulties. They, because of the society, they face a lack of eligible men to mate with. There's a real imbalance between eligible men who are willing to become fathers and want to become fathers, able to become fathers, and the girls and the women. There's the fact that the lifespan is very shortened, abbreviated in the inner cities. Black women in the inner cities have about a 20 years less life expectancy. So a young girl's mother is going to be around for a lot shorter period of time in her life. And then there's the birth outcomes. Black teenage girls in inner cities have the least chance of having a low birth weight baby if they give birth at age 16 and 17 than if they wait. This is the opposite for white girls and women living in suburbs, where you're going to have the highest incidence of low birth weight babies giving birth as a teen and a declining incidence when you get into your 20s. These things all combined, giving birth to healthier babies of normal birth weight, having your parents around, life expectancy issues, all and having fewer men as you get older available, all lead to an environment where in the inner city and you're in minority, you have a better chance of having give birth to a healthy child and have a family around to care for it if you give birth earlier rather than later. And this is reproductive strategy in action. This is Mother Nature's system in action. And the point being that we have our reproductive strategies based on our environment, because everyone, virtually everyone, wants to be a parent, give birth to healthy children, and the timing of births depends a lot upon your environment. Now, we as a society may not like this answer, my answer to that is similar to what I told one of the previous callers. We have to change the environment in order to make teenagers delay birth, and that means having a healthcare system that reaches the inner city so people are going to live longer and live healthier, and that poor people need this healthcare system especially. They also need a better living environment, jobs, better education system, all the things that would enable young men especially to live longer, live healthier, and enable couples to delay their childbearing when they're better able to bring up their children.
Okay. It's 11:44 on Focus 580. We have about 10 or 12 minutes left that we can take calls. The numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air.
I'm calling back again. With regard to teenagers and parental consent, teenagers don't ask their parents for consent to have sex. They go ahead and do it. Some do. And from what I have read, a teenager who gets birth control is more likely to have a parent involved in helping them than a teenager who doesn't go to get birth control. Think about how scary it would be to go and get your first pelvic examination and have somebody poke around in your private areas and ask you private questions. It's not something that a teenager who has never made their own appointment for a doctor it's not easy for them to do. And so I really oppose parental notification or consent for access to birth control.
Okay. Let's let Mr. Sanger comment on that.
I think it is incumbent on parents to have these conversations with their teenage daughters, especially teenage sons also, but especially their daughters, beginning at a very early age. Age 10 or 11, those young girls are likely to start menstruating. That's an opening to begin the conversation. Talk about human reproduction, talk about sex, talk about abstinence, and also talk about, honey, if you're going to have sex, I want you to be prepared ahead of time. Get to a Planned Parenthood, get to your reproductive health clinic, your county health department, your private doctor, whoever it is, before you're going to start to have sex. I think parents should be the first sex educators of their children. And many, alas, are not equipped to do it, but every Planned Parenthood in your listening area has programs to enable parents how to do this, and they'll teach you how to do it. And hopefully that, if every parent did this, we wouldn't have this discussion about parental consent, because teens would want to be talking to their mothers about it ahead of time.
Okay. Let's go to line two. Stelle, you're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Referring back to a point you made about how girls are maturing so early these years, this has been shown to come from the use of soy in the formula of babies. The soy, as you're probably well aware, is has so many estrogenic compounds in it that it's making girls mature much earlier, and many boys are not developing their male apparatus well enough. And it is tending to make boys more passive and girls more assertive.
That's interesting. Let's let Mr. Sanger comment on that.
Yeah, there's been a lot of study on the issue of chemicals in the environment and the effect upon the human reproductive system for boys and girls. There's been studies about grandparents being exposed to some chemical and their daughters' inability to conceive or their sons ending up with reproductive problems. There's a wonderful book called Our Stolen Future, which goes into this, which I recommend people reading. I think that a lot more work needs to be done by our environmental studies in our universities, looking at the effect on chemicals, looking at about whether that leads to more boys or girls being born and the effect on their reproductive systems. And I would encourage citizens out there, because it affects everyone. You can't avoid the chemicals that are in our food and in the things we drink, that we need to know a lot more about it in order to affect the study the effect on our reproduction.
Okay. Thanks for the call. I want to get to line four because we have someone on a cell phone from Clinton. You're on the air.
Yes, I just had a question about what this gentleman was talking about the reproductive strategy. He almost makes it sound like poor inner-city females have a booklet that says, get pregnant early while you got a support structure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, well, I just wanted to know what the devil he meant, because he's trying to bring it down to something instinctual. I don't hold any credence in that.
All right.
Anyway,
well,
I'll listen out.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
I think a lot of our reproductive strategies are instinctual. I think there is such a thing as human nature. And I think we have a desire to reproduce. I think that's part of our human nature. It is instinctual. And these instincts manifest themselves depending on the environment we're living in. It may be conscious, it may be unconscious for young people or not so young people to first of all get attracted to someone. We don't mate and have kids randomly. We get attracted to someone, and I've yet to meet the scientist or the poet who can explain the mysteries of human attraction. I think it's a lot of it's unconscious, and I think the same is true with the timing of childbearing. I think that there are things that women do see in the environment that, of course, they see consciously. The fact that they're going to have shortened lifespans, there are fewer men around, but I don't think women instinctively know they're going to give birth, have a better birth outcome if they give birth earlier rather than later, or later rather than earlier. I think that's maybe part of the instinct that's part of the human reproductive system. I think there are a lot of mysteries out there. In human and other animal reproductive strategies, and again, the whole field of evolutionary biology is just beginning to understand them.
Okay. We have a few minutes left. It's 11:50. We have a little over 5 minutes, and we could take calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Let's go to line one and Champagne right now. You're on the air with Alexander Sanger.
Good morning, Alex. This is a terribly interesting conversation. I just wanted to add, since you've been so good about touting Planned Parenthood and their work, I just wanted to add the issue about comprehensive sexuality education, which most of our schools are severely lacking. When we talk about teens being able to make responsible choices, they don't have much information to make those choices from. And so educating the parents is a big thing, but giving kids tools to work with in the schools is also an issue. And I know you're aware of that.
Oh, it is of huge importance, because a lot of teens are not going to have a parent with them when they encounter peer pressure, and when they're out on a date or, at a party, and someone approaches them and wants to get romantically or sexually involved. And so we have to equip our teenagers to deal with those situations. And I think comprehensive sex ed would involve not only information, but also a lot of role playing. And I think the classes ought to be mixed, boys and girls together. And girls ought to understand where the boys are coming from, and vice versa.
And, yes, absolutely.
And I think schools should be doing this. And if the schools don't have the teachers equipped to do it, I know every Planned Parenthood's got staff that are able to come into a school and do it. And I think we have to take the blinders off and realize, like it or not, our young people are sexual beings. They're maturing much too early for our liking, obviously, in many cases. That's the biological reality out there. And I think most parents want their kids to be protected and be safe, get to adulthood without having a disease or without being pregnant. I think that's what parents want, and that's what I think the schools ought to be providing.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. One thing I wanted to ask before we ended here was your views on genetic engineering. I found that that section very interesting, and I wonder if you could just talk about that for a minute.
Well, I think we really ought to go slow on genetic engineering. There's a lot we don't know. I have real concerns that we start trying to adjust some chromosome or some gene, that we're going to have unintended side effects. The rule of unintended consequences applies throughout science, but especially dealing with the human genome. I have a lot of sympathy with parents who are carriers of a genetic disease. There's some evidence that certain genes, we might be able to vary them somehow in a petri dish before we do artificial insemination and eliminate maybe hemophilia, or maybe we're getting to other diseases as well. But we got to go really slow, because we might be affecting some other part of the human genome. I think we got to be very, very careful about it. I instinctively believe in parents should make these choices, that they're the ones who are going to be bringing up a potentially disabled child, or a child that's not going to live nearly as long as he or she otherwise might. But I think a little bit of humility here and a lot of informed consent. This gets back to one of your earlier callers talking about informed consent. I think a lot of the risks, all the risks, certainly need to be explained before we leap into this unknown.
I just sort of made two notes to myself, because you make a distinction between genetic science and genetic engineering. I have genetic science good, genetic engineering bad. What is the difference, how do you see the difference in those terms?
Well, I think when you're doing actual research into how a disease gets carried from one generation to another, we certainly ought to be doing that research and exploring it. One of the interesting things is that usually it's the male child that is the carrier, likely to end up. It's the Y chromosome diseases that are much more likely. This raises interesting questions about sex selection abortion. If you think your child is going to be at risk for carrying a disease, it's much more likely to be a boy than a girl that's going to be the carrier. A lot of us in this society are worried about sex selection abortion being targeted against girls, where in fact, from a genetic point of view, it's going to be targeted against boys, which raises very, I think, interesting questions we all need to talk about. But I worry about doing things in a petri dish, modifying the human genome, even for the best of reasons, because we really don't know what the effect of other parts of the human genome are going to be. For the time being, I don't think it should be outlawed. I think we need to do this work. I know actually in Chicago last year, the year before, a woman with early Alzheimer's did some genetic manipulation so that she could get pregnant. I think that was a good thing. She wanted to be a mother and give birth to a healthy children. I think we just need to be aware of the risks, and genetic engineering is not a panacea for all that ails humanity.
Mm-hmm. And you've sort of touched on this earlier, but just sort of to wrap up here as we end our conversation, what do you feel is the role of government in reproductive strategy?
Well, I think the government ought to be certainly less involved than it is now in setting guidelines and in mandating decisions that human beings make about when and whether to reproduce and the timing of reproduction. I think government really should stay out of the whole decision-making about birth control and abortion. But because especially poor people need birth control and abortion in order to maximize their ability to give birth to healthy children, that we need a national healthcare system that covers these procedures. Because women need it at the time in their life when they're getting pregnant and giving birth. They may have health issues themselves. They may be at risk for giving birth to low birth weight babies. I think our government should try to alleviate this, for especially for poor people, because they're the ones who are most at risk for these conditions. Mm-hmm. And certainly providing prenatal care, universal prenatal care, is absolutely mandatory for our government to provide. And I would hope that your listeners have certainly, whatever their beliefs about abortion and birth control, they could get behind a program in Illinois to make sure that everyone who's pregnant gets access to prenatal care and postnatal care as well.
Okay. Mr. Sanger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate the time. We've been talking this morning on this in this hour of Focus to Alexander Sanger. His book, Beyond Choice, Reproductive Freedom in the 21st Century. Mr. Sanger will be in town tomorrow night. He's the featured speaker for the Planned Parenthood of East Central Illinois gala event celebrating 65 years of service. Again, Mr. Sanger, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate your time this morning.